Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, and now partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, we look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. This week we have the opportunity to hear Professor Elizabeth Warren, who is the head of the Congressional Oversight Panel. Besides being a scholar professor at Harvard, and she will be giving the November report on government-backed guarantees, which you can also get from the www.cop.senate.gov site. So here's Professor Warren.
I'm Elizabeth Warren, chair of the Congressional Oversight Panel. I'm here to introduce our November report, Guarantees and Contingent Payments in TARP and Related Programs. When Congress created the Troubled Asset Relief Program in late 2008, it provided Treasury with many different tools to combat the financial crisis. The main one was to permit Treasury to buy bad mortgage assets directly from financial institutions. But Treasury could also guarantee assets. Now, legally, a guarantee is just a promise to stand behind one party's obligation to another, like co-signing for a car loan. One of the biggest guarantees in our country started back during the Great Depression with FDIC insurance. The government guarantees that even if a bank fails, the money on deposit will be repaid. During the recent financial crisis, the federal government dramatically expanded its role as a guarantor. It increased the maximum FDIC guarantee from $100,000 to $250,000. At the same time, it made guaranteed money market funds, which had never been guaranteed before. But it went much further, also guaranteeing new bank debt, that is, backing up banks when they borrowed from investors. And Treasury guaranteed the value of hundreds of billions of dollars in assets from Citigroup and Bank of America, all so that other investors would lend to those struggling companies. Altogether, guarantees have formed the single largest plank of the government's response to the financial crisis. From the taxpayer's perspective, guarantees offer some real advantages. The most important is that guarantees don't cost anything up front. When government agencies agreed to guarantee $300 billion in Citigroup assets in late 2008, the taxpayers paid no immediate price, and it now appears that we could turn a profit from the fees that Citi paid for those guarantees. Also, the low upfront cost allowed Treasury to guarantee an enormous pool of assets. Because they didn't require spending any money, the guarantees weren't capped by the $700 billion that Congress had allocated to TARP. The results were easy to see. By raising FDIC guarantees and guaranteeing money market funds, Treasury protected the assets of millions of families, and it encouraged people to keep their money in banks and in money market funds even when the economy seemed very shaky. Similarly, commercial lenders who would not risk their money in distressed and uncertain markets agreed to put cash into banks after the U.S. government promised to backstop any losses. And the enormous size of the guarantees played a significant role in calming the financial markets last spring. but there have been real costs. Guarantees carry huge risks for taxpayers. The American taxpayer stood behind guarantees of high-risk assets held by institutions that in some cases were potentially insolvent. It was not a guarantee situation that anyone would want to walk into. Not only were the guarantees covering risky assets from shaky banks, if the guaranteed assets had fallen sharply in value, taxpayers could have suffered enormous losses. At its peak, the government was guaranteeing $4.3 trillion of financial assets. That's more than six times the total TARP allocation. We were very, very unlikely to lose most of that money, but the exposure was huge. Another important cost of these guarantees is their impact on markets. By limiting the amount of money that investors can lose in a deal, a guarantee distorts prices. For example, investors will pay more for stock in a bank whose assets are guaranteed than for stock in a similar bank that doesn't have the same guarantee. Think, for example, about how this benefits big banks over small banks if the former have guarantees and the latter do not. Guarantees can also encourage lenders to take on bigger risks, knowing that if they win, they keep the benefits, and if they lose, the taxpayer will back up their bad bets. This form of moral hazard can ultimately increase total risks in the marketplace. In addition, the government's broader economic stabilization effort may have signaled an implicit guarantee that the American taxpayer would bear any price and absorb any loss to avert a financial meltdown. For example, the guarantee for money market funds expired on September 18th with almost no fanfare. But some people believe that if times get rough again and money market funds threaten to sink in value below a dollar a share, the government will come right back in. Now, money market funds are paying nothing for a government guarantee right now, but the implicit guarantee is unmistakable. The same is true for too-big-to-fail financial institutions and other beneficiaries of government programs. So long as lenders and borrowers believe that an implicit guarantee remains in effect, the market will remain tangled with mispricing, moral hazard, and excess risk-taking. One technical note is worth calling out. After a wide-ranging review of several guarantees, the panel has not identified any significant flaws in Treasury's implementation of the programs. To the contrary, the panel has noted a trend. Over time, Treasury has been more aggressive in safeguarding the taxpayers' money, a move that we applaud. Nonetheless, in light of the extraordinary scale and the risk to the taxpayers that are posed by these guarantees, the panel believes that these programs should be subject to extraordinary transparency. The panel urges Treasury to disclose further details about the rationale behind guarantee programs and whether these programs have achieved their goals. The panel specifically calls out the Citigroup Asset Guarantee, which is the single largest guarantee offered to date, and it strongly urges Treasury to provide regular, detailed disclosures about the status of the assets backing up this guarantee. Now, you can read the full report and offer your own views on our website, cop.senate.gov. The impact of the guarantees that have been offered over the past year really can't be overstated. The magnitude of the intervention in the market has rewritten the basic rules of our financial system. By putting taxpayer money on the line to cover a private company's bad decisions, Treasury has crossed a threshold that has left us in unknown territory. The cost of the moral hazard that accompanies the explicit and implicit guarantees is not easily measured, but it remains a real and significant force in our financial system today.
If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I am speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. We were just listening to Professor Elizabeth Warren, who is also head of the Congressional Oversight Panel, give the November report on government-backed guarantees. Now I'd like to move on to the second segment of the show. We have been looking at the two-income trap, why middle-class mothers and middle-class fathers are going broke for the last month or so. And this actually is the name of a book by Professor Warren and her daughter Amelia Warren Tiagi, which has been the textbook for this portion of my educational show. And I highly recommend both the book, The Two Income Trap, and another book by Professor Warren and her daughter, All Your Worth, which are extraordinary works on helping people to understand and cope with their debt and finance problems and healing
their financial circumstances.
You can also go back in the archives at www.kruufm.com under Life and Debt and listen to any of the shows which have been produced about debt-related issues and, frankly, which often build one on the other to give you a very complete understanding of how to cope with your debt.
In the last couple of shows, I've been talking about the overconsumption myth, which is conceived of as an attempt to understand why particularly middle-class people are struggling financially and have for some time now. In prior shows, we actually went into the data which showed that it is a myth and then started unveiling the issue of where did the money go. One of the most important factors in the whole equation is the cost of housing. As I mentioned last week, the rise in housing costs has become a family problem. As I mentioned, home prices have grown across the board, particularly in large urban areas, but the brunt of price increases has fallen primarily on families with children. By way of data, the median home value for the average childless couple increased by 26% between 1984 and 2001, which of course is adjusted for inflation. Yet for married couples with children, housing prices shot up 78% during this period. In other words, three times faster. In dollar terms, in 1984, the average married couple with young children owned a house worth $72,000. And less than 20 years later, in 2001, a similar family bought a house worth $128,000. That is an increase of more than $50,000. It doesn't take a genius to recognize that the growing costs of such a house made a big dent in the family budget. Monthly mortgage costs made a great jump, regardless of the reduction in interest rates over those years. Couples with children obviously are spending more than ever on housing. So the question was asked, why would the average parent spend so much money on a home? Well, the overconsumption theory doesn't offer many insights about this. According to all the data and research that Professor Warren and her daughter did, the real reason lies in those two words we discussed, safety and education. Essentially, families put mom to work, used up family's economic reserves, and took on crushing debt loads for safety and education to give the kids the best possible start in life. That doesn't seem like any great surprise. And the best possible start always begins with good schools in the education factor, and parents are scrambling to find those schools. And education does relate to money, particularly for middle-class children. Failing schools impose an enormous cost on those children who are forced to attend them, but they also inflict an enormous cost on those who don't. It's really the other side of the coin. Middle-class parents in major metropolitan areas use their time, money, and effort to find a slot for the children in a decent school. In some situations, it's people leaving the public school system altogether, opting for private, parochial, or homeschooling, which has substantial costs to it. Yet for most parents, ensuring that their children get a decent education translates into one thing, and this is really at the core of major debt issues, and that is getting a home in the small subset of school districts that have managed to hold on to a reputation of high quality and parent confidence. Buy a home there. Now, of course, homes have all kinds of amenities, two-car garages, being close to work or to shopping, or being in a low crime rate area. And as I mentioned last week, a study conducted in Fresno, California, which had 400,000 residents at the time, found that for similar homes, school quality was the single most important determinant of neighborhood prices, more important than racial composition of the neighborhood, commute distance, crime rate, or even proximity to a hazardous waste site. Another study in suburban Boston showed the impact of school boundaries. Two homes located less than half a mile apart and similar in nearly every aspect will command significantly different prices if they are in different elementary school zones. Schools that scored just 5% higher on fourth grade math and reading tests added a premium of nearly $4,000 to nearby homes. Even though the homes were virtually the same in terms of neighborhood character, school spending, racial composition, tax burden, and crime rate. Education and home location is very, very critical in the financial equation. Another good example was University City, the West Philadelphia neighborhood surrounding the University of Pennsylvania. In an effort to improve the area, the university committed funds for a new elementary school. So the results? Well, at the time of the announcement, the median home value in the area was less than $60,000. Jump ahead 5 years, and the homes within the boundaries go now for about $200,000, even if they need to be totally renovated. The neighborhood is otherwise pretty much the same. And yet, in just 5 years, families are willing to pay more than triple the price for a home just so they can send their kids to a better public elementary school. As Professor Warren points out, real estate agents have long joked that the three things that matter in determining the price of a house are location, location, location. And she has now indicated that the mantra has been updated. It is now schools, schools, schools.
And this pressure about schools has really increased quite a lot. The idea that schools were functioning considerably well 3-4 decades ago has reversed considerably. Today, the majority of parents now believe that schools have gotten significantly worse. About half of all Americans are dissatisfied with America's public education system, and this is a deep concern shared by both black and white parents. And these facts are based on hard data. Even according to Juliet Skuhr, a leading critic of overconsumption, she states that within the middle class and even the upper middle class, many families experience an almost threatening pressure to keep up, both for themselves and for their children. They are deeply concerned about the rigors of the global economy and the need to have their children attend good schools. And here's the point. This means living in a community with relatively high housing costs. So the bottom line, according to Professor Warren, is that the only way to ensure that one's youngsters get a solid education is to buy that three-bedroom colonial with an hour-long commute to a job in the city. Again, the bottom line is the school is in a good school district
which attracts the parents to buy a house. And of course, the price of the house is increasingly higher, particularly in a competitive housing market. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So the first point we've considered is that education has a lot to do with the cost of housing, which, of course, has a lot to do with the family's finances. And the second point, along with education, which I mentioned earlier, was safety. Today's parents confront the frightening prospect, which seems to have at least hit the media, is the threat of school violence. So considering what school your children attend, the safety of the school is a very important issue. The media widely publicize rise in shootings, gangs, and dangerous drugs at public schools, which of course results in many parents searching for a safer haven for their sons and daughters. Now, even though we've heard about those horrors like in Columbine, which was a very lovely neighborhood and school district, the statistics show that school violence is not as random as it might seem. According to one study, the incidence of serious violent crimes, robbery, rape, attack with a weapon, is more than 3 times higher in schools characterized by high poverty levels than those with predominantly middle and upper income children. Urban school children are more than twice as likely as suburban children to fear being attacked on the way to or from school. Again, this is according to data Professor Warren has analyzed. In all, the data really has exposed a very harsh reality. Parents who can get their children into more economically segregated neighborhood improve the odds that their sons and daughters will make it through school safely. So safety is another issue. The fact is that newer, really more isolated suburbs with very restrictive zoning promise a refuge from random crimes that are really tarnishing urban living. While it is true that the crime rate in the United States has actually dropped over the last few decades, looking at the national statistics doesn't show the differences among communities and the disparities which have grown over time. In fact, in many cities, urban centers have grown much more dangerous, while outlying areas have gotten safer. The result is that parents feel the pressure to live in a suburban refuge. So if we just look at some cities like Baltimore and Philadelphia, the crime rate fell in the surrounding suburbs just as it increased in the center city. And the disparities are really the greatest for the most frightening violent crimes. Now, although the crime rate may have climbed in many urban areas, the average family faces only really a minuscule exposure to a random act of violence in a major city. Yet the psychology is very critical here. Parents worry. Parents are constantly mindful of the vulnerability of their children, and frankly, no amount of statistical reasoning can persuade them to stop being worried. Now, according to Professor Warren, families have long acknowledged crime as an unfortunate fact of life, but the effect on parents has definitely changed. A generation ago, there really wasn't much that the average parent could do to escape the hazards. People bought guard dogs, left their lights on, but the suburbs were about as troubled as the cities, so the impetus to move wasn't very compelling. Today, though, cities and suburbs seem to present very two distinct alternatives. People are looking to the suburbs as a safer alternative. According to one study, more than one-third of families who had left central Baltimore and over half of the families who had considered leaving were moved to do so by their fear of crime. So what we're seeing here is a huge psychological factor. what matters is what the parents believed was the important difference between cities and suburbs, and that the difference was growing. And the only answer for millions of these kinds of parents is to buy a home in a decent school district in a safe neighborhood, whatever the cost. So what this led to was bidding wars in the suburbs. As Professor Warren indicates, the middle-class families across America had been quietly drawn into an all-out war. It's interesting to note that this war has received little coverage in the press and no attention from politicians, but it has profoundly really altered the lives of parents everywhere, shaping every economic decision that they make. The war is really a bidding war. It really was in the context of the most ordinary kind of circumstances, as individual parents sought out homes they thought were good places to bring up the kids. But as families saw urban centers as an increasingly unattractive place to live, the range of desirable housing options began to shrink, and parents' desire to escape from failing schools began to take on new urgency. So across America, millions of parents joined in the search for a house on a safe street with a good school nearby. So what we saw was that over time, as this demand heated up, the number of available houses decreased, and the bidding war would take off. We see parents bidding for suburban homes in good school districts. But along with that, there was some new artillery, in a way, that was brought into the war, and that was a second income. Now we had an era when the overwhelming majority of mothers were bringing home a paycheck and covering a big part of the family's bills. Not too long ago, just within our memory, most middle-class mothers, including those in the workforce, made only modest contributions to the family expenses. A generation ago, the average working wife contributed just one quarter of the family's total income. In many families back then, mom's earnings were treated as what we call pin money to cover treats and extras, not mortgages and car payments. And this did not come only from the husband. Banks and loan companies routinely ignored women's earnings in calculating whether to approve a mortgage, on the theory that a wife might leave the workforce at any moment to pursue full-time homemaking. But then in 1975, Congress passed an important law with far-reaching consequences for families' housing choices. That law was the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, which stipulated, among other things, that lenders could no longer ignore a wife's income when judging whether a family earned enough to qualify for a mortgage. By the early 1980s, a woman's participation in the labor force had become a significant factor in whether a married couple could buy a home. Both families and banks had started down the path of counting mom's income as an essential part of the monthly budget. And we will continue on next week with the story of the bidding war in the suburbs.
This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. Speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt-manageable life.